Calling State Affairs Committee to order at 3:04 p.m. The clock's an hour fast, as was noted earlier. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Wool?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Co-Chair Fields?
Here.
Co-Chair Carson?
Here. With seven members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence any cell phones that you might have today. And this is the first meeting for State Affairs in 2019. Also, Representative Story's first committee meeting, I believe,
yes,
her soon-to-be illustrious legislative career. Excited to get things off with some confirmation hearings. I wanted to quickly overview the schedule for this week. We'll be hearing from Commissioner-designee Dahlstrom and Commissioner-designee Price. And as I have sidebarred with both, we'll take committee questions today. We did not notice public testimony. And as is the custom in this committee, we like to offer public testimony for all appointments as well as pieces of legislation. So we'll get sort of a second bite of the apple probably next week or soon thereafter to make sure that that happens. But wanted to put that out up front. We also have three bills on the calendar for Thursday. Co-Chair Fields and I will be sort of rotating back and forth, platooning, if you will, in the committee chair position for the honor of sitting next to Representative Wool, I guess. And also would like to thank Martha, the records secretary, as well as Madison in the back for facilitating the meeting. So with that, we can get to our one more item of business. In terms of finance subcommittees, there'll be two finance subcommittees affiliated with this committee, same as the previous 2 years, Department of Administration and the University of Alaska. I haven't yet conferred with the finance members who will be chairing each of those committees. Representative Johnston will be chairing the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee, and Representative Josephson will be chairing the UA Finance Subcommittee. I think there's some likelihood that the UA Finance Subcommittee will meet at a somewhat later time and also invite members of the Education Committee to sort of maximize the Venn diagram overlap there, given intersecting subject matter, and also to provide more time for that budget to be considered, as opposed to cramming everything into a 1.5 to 2 hour slot. So details forthcoming in terms of both of those finance subcommittees. But we should know certainly by Thursday. So first item of two items of business is Commissioner-designee Dahlstrom. Please come forward and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee. My name is Nancy Dahlstrom, and I'm happy to be before you today.
Thank you very much for making the time today. And for both of these confirmation hearings, basically want to open up to members of the committee. As a sort of matter of mechanics, I'll keep a queue. So if you have a question, flag me, and I'll sort of run through in order. So any questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you ask, we have questions now. We can have questions. This, we're going to hear a presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, actually.
I don't want to forego my whole questioning.
No. Good
privilege
point. Commissioner-designee, I'm out of practice. If you wouldn't mind, maybe give your biographic sketch, especially since you've been around the Capitol quite a bit through the years.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm happy to do that. It's an honor to be here before you today, and I'll give you a little bit of background about me. I've been in Alaska nearly 40 years, and I'm married to a really good guy named Kit. We have four children who were all raised in Alaska, and we have 10 grandchildren. Throughout my professional life, I've had the opportunity to work in the public sector and in the private sector. And as you know, I represented the Eagle River area for 8 years previously. I'm before you today because the governor has asked me to serve as the Commissioner of Corrections, and I was honored to accept his offer. It's no secret that I don't have a corrections background. And then again, this administration hasn't been doing business as usual. What I do have is a professional and educational skill set and the abilities to work with people to identify problems and opportunities, to create a path to address them, to build the team to implement, and ultimately to execute the decisions to make that makes me the right choice for this job. It's a position I take very seriously, and I am up for the task. The department's mission is to provide secure confinement, reformative programs, and community reintegration. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what my goals are for the department. It's important to me to ensure that our employees and all of the inmates are safe. The reentry programs are very important to me, helping inmates transition back into society successfully. And recruitment and retention are extremely important to me. We need to attract and retain qualified employees, which is our correctional officers, our probational officers, nurses, and the other medical staff that we have in the facilities. I've only been on the job a few short months, but I've already made some positive changes. Several policies have been suspended or amended. I felt that was needed to be done in order to bring attention back to where it belongs, and that's the focus on the safety of our employees and inmates, and honoring and recognizing victims and their right. I'm also committed to programs that help those who are incarcerated reintegrate back into society when that's going to be possible. I do know that people make mistakes, and through many of our programs, which are faith-based or work-based, substance abuse and other programs, we can help so that folks can become law-abiding citizens again. I've brought on a new team member this week who has extensive experience in criminal justice and reentry, and am excited she's joining us, and this is going to be her primary focus is reentry. DOC has a dedicated staff of 1,900 men and women around the state, and it's no secret that hiring these men and women and retaining them can be difficult. I've created a working group who is dedicated to addressing the issues head on that they face and challenges and opportunities that we have as we look at gaining employees and keeping those that we have. And again, in closing, I want to thank you for being here today and for this opportunity to present to you. And I look forward to answering your questions and working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee. Representative Wohl?
I don't have to go first, but no, I didn't have a specific question at that moment. That's okay. Why I didn't want to give up the right, though.
Anybody else questions?
I've got lots of questions.
Representative Liu.
So periodically, you hear about drugs or other contraband being smuggled into our correctional system, sometimes with the help of people who are working there. If what I'm hearing is correct, do you have any plans to address that, and if so, how?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think that that's a serious concern. I have heard some things, and I have started to address them. I think it would be inappropriate for me in this committee to say some of the ways we're looking internally at those situations, but I do know that there is a real concern, and drugs in the facility brought in by anybody is a problem and isn't acceptable.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. Commissioner Dahlstrom, thanks for stating your support for reentry programs, and I know we talked about that when we met previously. Can you talk about your short-term and medium-term goals in terms of stronger reentry programs? I see in this folder that my staff prepared that we have actually made progress reducing the recidivism rate, which is really exciting. It's come down by about 6 points, which is actually a big deal. And I think part of the success, as you note, is that the state has been working with nonprofit and faith-based groups to improve reentry. So I know there are a lot of opportunities, and if you could just talk about some of those, I'd appreciate that.
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Fields. I do care very much, as I've said with you previously and here today, about reentry. And as I mentioned, I have a new gal that just started Monday. I have tasked her with assessing every program that we have and are currently involved with, and others that are available that we might become involved with, so that we can see what's there, resources that we can take advantage of to help our inmate population And that is her priority, and it's a top priority of mine. So I can't give you specifics right now on any of the programs, but I am aware that we have several avenues we can go down and many people that are concerned and want to help.
Follow up. In that vein, one thing I would like to see is consistent tracking of percentage of inmates and folks who have been released and are on parole who have offender management plans. And of those offender management plans, which ones address employment, substance abuse, housing? Yeah, I guess those would be at least those three things. Because, you know, substantively, it seems like DOC has made a lot of progress in expanding the number of folks with offender management plans. It would be good to track over time to make sure that we're reaching a broader and broader population of inmates and parolees, and that of those offender management plans, they're meaningful and not just kind of a check-the-box process, but they actually do address the critical factors that are going to influence whether someone can be successful after being released.
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, I couldn't agree with you more. Those are things that will be tracked, and I look forward to working with you in the future. I know this is an area of great concern to you also.
Representative Shaw.
Question with a follow-up. Is there in your budget a correctional facility that may be closed?
Through the chair, Representative Shaw, the budget has a projection for closing part of the Wildwood facility.
And then follow-up. In that facility, I met with a social worker from the facility yesterday. She says there's the potential of 46 employees being affected by that partial closure. Is that true?
Through the chair, there are 46 PCNs that could be affected. And what I have expressed to the employees in a letter and verbally is that I would like to absorb and plan to absorb those folks into other institutions.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yeah, I had a question on something earlier, but I wanted to follow up on Representative Shaw's question. And that was, I'm sorry, but I don't know the reason why for closing the section that you were talking about.
Through the chair, Representative Story, the budget contains changes that should they, every one of them, be brought to fruition would include that closure. The budget also has a projection of moving 500 potentially inmates out of state to other facilities. Should that happen, the hope was to take those folks that are in Wildwood and move them into the other institutions so that they would be able to take advantage of the programs and things that are there and mothball that building.
Follow up. So this is part of the proposal to close one of the facilities and or to ship inmates out of Alaska.
Through the chair, that was proposed in the budget. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Has there been talk about the effects of we've done this before in Alaska's history, and I know effects on the family. I have heard some detrimental effects on the families involved and the inmates involved. Has there been any reason to, is there any reason that those effects, negative effects is what I thought would be different this time?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I have become quite familiar with what happened in the past and learned some things from reading about that experience. One of the things that, should this happen, I would like to do differently is instead of bringing people back with just a month or so left to go before they're released, have long-term prisoners outside and brought back when they have 2 to 3 years left so they can start integrating in. As far as effects on families and things, that's a natural consequence of being incarcerated.
Follow up?
Yes, there are a lot of effects for being incarcerated, and I think that certainly people experience those consequences. I think that we really always remember, though we always are respecting the person and trying to do, just trying to be as respectful as possible and as healing as possible, because as we know, 90%, I think it's that high, come back after being incarcerated and come back into our communities. And for that to be a successful reentry, I think your time and quality of experience and training and certainly having consequences to actions, but I think it's really important to look at those long-term effects. I also think I am really hoping that when people are looking at the cost of sending, I can't remember the dollar amount, outside to house prisoners, I know it's quite an extensive amount, and I would rather myself look at having that money inside the state and paying out the state money inside the state, because I also believe there are, we benefit businesses supporting, not only do you have the inmates in their home community or their home state, you have the benefits of businesses supporting the institution and the indirect costs to the community that sometimes I think might make up the cost savings that you're looking at. So I'm hoping that analysis is being done. Do you know if that analysis is being done?
Through the chair, Rep Story, an official analysis is not being done at present, but it is something that I'm definitely taking into consideration.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I just wanted to kind of get back to this being your confirmation and discussing the missions, the department's mission. And I guess my first question is, do you have any say over the budget with the department?
Through the chair, clarification, did I put a number in? Is that what you're asking me?
Follow-up. No, do you have any leeway as to how the monies are going to be implemented? Do you have a say in whether the facility Wildwood would be closed? Anything having to do with the employees, is that part of your decision process, or does that belong to someone else?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance, those budgetary decisions were made by OMB.
Follow-up. So as you get a budget from year to year, what is your plan to work with each prison, each facility, and the employees that you have in order to maintain the department's mission and the goals that you outlined of safety, reentry, recruitment? You know, we have more than just this budget to look at for your confirmation. How do you plan to work with each budget as they come year to year?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the first thing I will tell you is that I will follow the law and I will abide by the budget that is given to me by this body and the governor. And so with that being said, anytime there's a change, you know, in that, I will most likely be doing some juggling and reevaluating and what's working and what can we do better and making sure we're spending our money properly.
An additional question? Yes. The other question that I have is regarding, you know, safety. You listed one of your first goals is the employee and inmate safety. And there's a lot of controversy around some of our inmates going out of state. Some of the things that I've heard is that we have a high level of aging and inmates with high cost of medical needs, like, for instance, people on dialysis that would be much more affordable in the lower 48. Is that part of maintaining their safety and finding efficiencies? Is that the bulk of the number that is being placed in facilities outside?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's not the bulk, but those folks are certainly in my consideration as far as can we get them the care that they need, the best care. There's certain things with medical that, we work with our medical folks and the doctor at the prison and the facilities that are available where those services that can be determined as how many choices of places that we can put them so that they can be properly cared for. But as far as looking at anybody with medical issues and saying, oh, we'll move you all out, it hasn't been looked at as a group like that.
Thank you.
Representative Fields?
Thanks. Following up on my colleague's questions about shipping inmates outside, so I heard you say that you did not propose the partial closure of Wildwood. That was an OMB proposal. I'm guessing that it was also an OMB proposal to ship inmates outside.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, that is projected in the budget.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. What is the recidivism rate for inmates who have been incarcerated outside versus in Alaska? I think we've heard anecdotally that outside prisons, often run by private for-profit companies, are a criminal training ground.
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, that's some information I would need to look into and get back with you. We haven't had prisoners out of state for several years, and so I'd need to look at what it was compared to now and then adjust the percentages accordingly, but I can certainly look into that.
Okay. I guess I would just say my colleague from Homer makes a good point that if we're saving a cut, and from Juneau make a good point that if we're saving a couple bucks now but ultimately getting higher recidivism rates and more crime, are we really saving money? I do have more questions. I would be happy to defer to other colleagues if other folks have questions.
Right. I might sneak one in the – or actually – very chivalrous, Representative Wall. Thank you. So I have a question, I guess, along the lines of what Representative Vance and Representative Fields were asking, which is there's clear sort of line of, sort of control and sort of policymaking ability between OMB and the commissioner's office, seemingly. You're not the only commissioner for which this is true. It exists in every administration, so it's a question where the line is. Where does your scope of authority begin and end vis-a-vis OMB and vis-a-vis the governor's office in terms of making corrections related to policy?
To the chair. I will tell you that I have open communication with OMB and with the governor's office, and I am free to talk with them about anything I, think is important to talk with them about, and I don't take any of these things like that have been mentioned, moving prisoners out or different things, I don't take any of that lightly, and so there won't be anything done without full analysis and, deep looking into it to make sure that it's not just a financial issue, but that there will be proper care for the inmates.
I guess a follow-up I would ask in that vein is, are there sort of policymaking areas as far as corrections goes that you have sole and sort of singular authority that you don't have to run up the chain, and sort of what are those areas?
Through the chair to the committee, I have authority over all the policies in our department.
Okay. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess following up on that, the decision whether to move people to out-of-state prisons, that could fall on you, and you could make a decision on that independently of the administration, for example.
Through the chair, that's correct.
And follow up. Do you have a position on that? Like that policy in and of itself, just on a macro view, would that be something you would be interested in pursuing, or could you say categorically, I'm not really interested in moving people out of state, if at all possible?
Through the chair, Representative Wolbe, it was proposed in the budget, and I am doing my due diligence in pursuing all the information I can on that. And once that's completed, we'll make a decision on it.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a bunch of different random questions, and I don't have to go all at the same time. So I guess regarding sort of closing Wildwood, and you said you would try to keep all the people in place and reassign them. And I think if I understood correctly, the last time that was done, a facility was closed, that in fact the personnel were shifted to other areas where maybe they were needed. So when these things have happened, there hasn't been a lot of people being let go, but just reassigned. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I can't speak specifically about what happened in a previous closure, but I know that my goal and intent in this case is that we would retain everyone that wished to be retained.
Follow up? Yeah, so, and you had also said that some of these people would be, I can't remember exactly what you said, but that you would close a facility, people would go to a new facility, and the people that were there were potentially going to be shifted out of state. I got that wrong. You're shaking your head. what was the flow there exactly, please?
Through the chair, Rep. Well, you're talking about the employees, or are you talking about the inmates?
Well, I would think they go hand in hand to some degree. I guess the inmates first. So there was a flow of inmates, because if you moved 400 or 500 out of state, there'd be some vacancies, and the vacancies would be occupied by the closing of Wildwood. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Wool, it's kind of correct. There is an official process of classification of inmates, and so what would happen is when a decision is made, then that process would start on looking at the inmates, which ones could potentially go out of state or which ones would need to stay in state there's various reasons. So that process would have to happen. There is one employee left with us within the department who has been here since this happened previously, so they do have some experience with that. It's a long time, very well thought of employee. But as far as employees being transferred out of state, no. They could transfer to other facilities. Some may wish to do that since they work week on, week off. Some may wish to drive down the road to Seward.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's fair to say, though, if, for example, 500 inmates were sent to out of state, Arizona, or wherever, that would result in, that in and of itself would result in a less of a need for some of your 1,900 people that you oversee right now, that if you move 500 people out, you could release a bunch of PCNs that you wouldn't need. I mean, obviously, or why would you do it?
Through the chair, Rep. Wool, I think that that's highly unlikely possibility, and the reason I say that is because every year we average about 120 employment changes a year, and that's not people transferring, that's people that for whatever reason leave the department. And for example, one day last week, there was 55 medical positions open, 75 correctional positions, and 30 probation positions open around the state. So those people didn't transfer. We have some folks who I'm sure are thinking about retiring. And honestly, we would probably lose a few employees, but the hope and my plan is to keep everyone.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the question was losing PCNs. Another through attrition and retirement, mm-hmm. that if you did shift a bunch of people outside, you wouldn't necessarily have to let people go. Some of it would happen on its own, but your payroll would go down, correct?
Through the chair, if I understand what you're saying, then yes, correct.
Okay, thank you. I do have more questions, but I'll give up the floor for a minute.
We'll cycle back to you. Representative Vance.
I just want to follow on that thread. Thank you for allowing the question. It's with seeing so much attrition, you talked about creating a working group for employees. What kind of culture shift do you plan to implement, you know, and carry out? Because obviously you as the commissioner sets the tone for the entire department, and that carries on to every employee. How do you plan to do that, and what is something that you would like to see happen in the overall tone of the department?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I think that's a good question. The group will be is a combination of folks covering every area in the facility, and I have not given them a specific goal to work towards because I want it to be employee driven, and I want them to talk about and tell me what it is that they need or that might be missing or that we could do better or ways to improve. The tone that I have set and that I've always operated on is that I have an open door policy, and I will listen, and I do listen, and try to take their suggestions and bring them to fruition if it is possible. We do have limitations as far as you know, they're represented employees and in different unions, and so we need to abide by that. But I value each and every one of those employees and what they do. So I'm putting a lot of trust in them that they're going to bring to my attention what it is we can do.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. So we, Commissioner Dahlstrom, we recently learned through a look back at Medicaid expansion, the state has actually saved money in terms of its general fund with Medicaid expansion. In other words, we are spending less through general fund dollars today than when we expanded Medicaid, and much of that savings has come through inmates. Could you talk about continued opportunities you see to achieve general fund cost savings through the Medicaid expansion population with your department?
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, I'm not sure I understand all of that. What I can tell you is that anybody that's in one of our facilities, all their medical costs are incurred by the state. We are not able to bill Medicaid for 1 cent of anything while they're in our facility.
If I understand correctly, the division of costs that could be covered through Medicaid expansion is folks who are getting their treatment outside the facility but who are still in DOC custody. Wouldn't claim to be an expert on Medicaid, but that is a significant share of cost savings from the state general fund.
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, I would be happy to get back with you and the entire committee on that. I need to get some numbers and some more information.
Great.
Follow up
on a slightly different subject. I know that historically we've had a strong prison industries program. Mm-hmm. That's been an important part of reentry. Could you talk about your vision for expanding prison industries without competing with the private sector or displacing Alaskans who currently have good jobs? Because obviously we want to create career opportunities for folks returning to society without taking away a job from someone who maybe wasn't previously incarcerated. So talk about that balance.
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, those that know me well know that I believe in work, and work is really important for people's health, their physical, mental, spiritual, social. I think that good, hard, strong work ethics are really important, and when they're learned, they help people succeed in life too. So with that being said, I am supportive of work programs. We have programs in several of the institutions. Some of them, they're paid an income. Some of them, they're not paid, but they're learning skills. I think they're important. I would like to add to those. And there's been several areas that I've had my eyes open to, areas that we can improve, and different industries that we can involve in that. And I can tell you that I'm looking at that and talking with those folks. So I wouldn't want to say any organization's name on the record right at the moment, but that is important to me, and I agree with the value of that.
Representative Story.
Thank you. I think one thing that would be really important, because we have talked a little bit about how you're going to be looking for some work programs, job training programs that help when people return to the community, that they will have skills that are 21st century skills, perhaps, that really there is a job market out there for them, and we need to fill these spots, and they're more apt to be successful when they enter. So when you're doing this program, I was wondering if there is a certain amount, do you have know a certain amount of employees that will be released, the timelines, the goals for what programs, like what is the demand for the programs out there? First you have to know, and then what goals can you set in the department as you overlook trying to get the people within your care, so to speak, ready to be successful when they return to their communities. Is there a system that you can develop, or have you thought about what is the number I'm serving? What do we need to have? You know, what you have to have a goal, a vision to get there, and a certain amount and timelines. And has there been any thought to that?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I have given that a lot of thought. And in corrections, we have some interesting dynamics in that. You know, we don't pick who comes in the door, and we don't pick when they go out. So we have some folks for a longer period of time, some for a shorter period. People come in with different attitudes about wanting to learn new skills or any skills or the importance of it. But I think that being able to track what we're offering and know the success of that program is very important, and that's something that we're working on as we talk about, you know, some of these other programs that, you know, the measures of it, the outcomes, are they successful? Because that's where we should spend time and efforts and resources, and on, rather than something that's not successful.
Follow up?
Yes, is this part of our reentry programs and having reentry coaches, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Story, you know, it would be ideal if every person getting out could have a reentry coach. But I stress again that the reentry is very important to me, and I want to grow those programs, and I want them to be successful. You know, oftentimes, again, with the different situations with folks, some that are released straight out, some that will go to a halfway house, some are on probation, some aren't. But ideally, it would be wonderful if everybody left there with a plan and somebody that was a coach or mentor or, you know, appear to be able to help them. And we knew, where are you going? Where are you going to be living? How are you going to get there? Do you have a job? How are you going to pay your rent? You know, someone that could go over those things and ask them, because again, depending on how long they've been in, some of them may have never had that experience in life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. What is your budget for reentry? And I do know, if I remember, that there was $1 million turned away in federal reentry funding, and I'm curious about why and your decision on that, but then I'm wondering, what is the budget?
Through the chair, Rep. Story, I cannot tell you the dollar amount for specifically just reentry, but I can try to get that and get it to everybody. But the $1 million grant that folks have talked about, I turned it down. I am the one that turned it down, and the reason why it would set up an infrastructure and things within the department that really weren't directly touching the client. And after several months, that money would have been gone. It was one time. It wasn't coming back, and we would not have been able to continue that funding. So I felt it was the most responsible thing to do.
Follow up.
Yeah, I would hope if we had an opportunity like that is to look in an area with where we got some grant money, it was valuable. If there was one-time things we could do, like perhaps training for reentry coaches or training in certain areas, which it isn't ongoing funds, you just capitalize on getting that amount of money. I'm sure there's many reasons, many things that could be done. But I would, is that something that you're open to if those grants come along and looking at maybe money isn't going to be able to be regenerated next year, but you could find some one-time uses within that category?
Through the Chair, Rep Story, I'm absolutely open to that. And when those situations are applied for or we are approached about them, I want to, if it's possible, make sure that we have the authority to be able to use those funds the way we see fit and that will help our inmates.
Thank you.
And I'm going to squeeze in a quick question before going to Representative Vance and Representative Wohl. And I wanted to, well, for 3/7 of the committee, we sort of have the benefit of comparison and contrast from the previous commissioner and their previous administration. And through different pieces of legislation and committee hearings, we had a sense of where Department of Corrections was headed. And I'm sure you, as a particularly informed, engaged member of the public the last couple of years, also had a sense of where the agency was headed. How would you describe changes that you envision making into the direction the agency is taking vis-a-vis where it was headed under the previous commissioner, and what do you plan to continue philosophically or programmatically?
Through the chair and committee, I'm really not trying to avoid that question, but I want to tell you that I never had the opportunity to work with the previous commissioner. I have not met him, and there were many good things done in the department, and there's changes that I have made, and there's changes that I will continue to make, but it's not a reflection of me not liking how that person did something.
Have you spoken with him, not in person, but on the phone?
Through the chair, Kais Tompkins, I have not. My understanding is that he's employed out of state.
Okay. Just a comment. I mean, of course, every commissioner can and should take the agency wherever she or he makes fit, but I would think in the course of a transition, there's probably always information or knowledge to be gleaned from one's predecessor. And you know, even if there are even profound philosophical differences, and just a comment that it seems like there could be a benefit or upside just in terms of running the agency on a day-to-day basis to have those conversations. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I'd like to step back to the question of the $1 million federal funding that you turned down, and you know, with the budget considerations, there's been obvious criticism on why you took that, and you said that that dollar figure didn't reach the actual client, it didn't touch them. Can you talk more to that and help us understand what the requirements were with that you said that we couldn't maintain it? You know, could you speak more specifically? I think we're having a hard time understanding why this money was not accepted and utilized, just as much as you can speak, you know, more specifically on what it was and what it would have entailed for us to continue that. I think that would help in your reflecting on you.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the information that I had on the grant, I would have been required to bring some other employees on to have a place for them to operate, the equipment for them to operate with, and we would get a program going, and then I would have to end the program.
Follow up. Did you know if there was any projected dollar amount on what it would be to maintain the program and what that program specifically would have been?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it fell under the reentry programs. The information that I received was there was no way we could reapply because I looked at that avenue. Is there even a 50-50 chance we can apply, you know, reapply every year and maybe we'll get it and we can continue this? It was a one-time end of discussion grant.
Follow up. So what they were, so you said you would have to hire more employees, and then after that money went out, you would have to essentially let them go or absorb them back into the department?
Through the chair, yes, I would have had to let them go.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. And Commissioner Dalsimer, in a previous job when I was working for the State Department of Labor, I ended up being out at Anvil Mountain, and I think what they call their education center, mm-hmm. which is basically where they have computers and books for inmates to do rehabilitation programs. And when I was there, I was shocked when they had a room full of computers. Literally none of them worked. So inmates of that facility were not able to do important reentry-related tasks, you know, adult basic education to get a GED. We ended up transferring computers from the Department of Labor to DOC. We sent them out to Anvil Mountain so they would have functional computers. So I guess I would just ask, could you commit that you would talk to your to the supervisors at all your facilities to make sure that their education and training rooms, such as they are at each facility, actually have functional equipment? I know that sounds like such a basic task, but, you know, I was out at Anvil Mountain halfway through an administration, and the most basic equipment was not even functional.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I can commit to that, and I think that that's important, and they have the right to have that service there.
Great, thank you. Follow-up question.
Follow-up.
We haven't talked quite as much yet on DOC effectively as a substance abuse series of treatment centers. I know inmates involuntarily detox in many circumstances, and that DOC has started doing some medically assisted treatment. Could you talk about, with a high percentage of inmates who have substance abuse issues, what's kind of your short and medium-term plan on integrating substance abuse treatment with folks who are withdrawing and who need treatment in order to reduce the likelihood that they start using again when they are released?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I think that the point you brought up is very important, and that is a problem, a situation that corrections isn't going to be able to fix on its own. That's a universal thing that every department is dealing with as far as addiction and the substance abuse. And I will tell you again, when we know that somebody is detoxing, there's every effort made to keep them safe. They're monitored on a regular basis. I mean, vitals taken. There's every effort made to keep them safe. But the same token, we're not a mental health facility. So that's part of this whole discussion that we're having with corrections and HESS, and how are we going to look at the addiction problem, and how are we going to work with substance abuse? What I can tell you and I can commit to you is that I know it's a serious problem, and I care about it, and I want to help do something about it, and that I am committed. This department will be a part of the positive answer, you know, in working towards that. I don't have all the answers, though.
I guess follow-up comment, if I might. whether we like it or not, essentially DOC is a mental health treatment agency, and I guess I would just hope that as you continue to look at dealing with a population with a very high incidence of addiction, that DOC could work with HESS on ensuring that there's counseling available along with medically assisted treatment, mm-hmm. and counseling for those folks who are detoxing, to increase the likelihood that they succeed after they've detoxed. Kind of modeling that on what nonprofit providers do outside of the correctional space. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have a couple graphs here on recidivism, and you said you don't control who comes in your facility or how long they stay, but you do probably have some influence on how soon they come back to some degree. Unlike a hotel, you don't want them back. I hope that's the case. Three or four charts here, and some of them are kind of not as bad as I thought they would be. Recidivism for new crimes is 32%, and recidivism for felonies, returning for a felony, is 20%. So when we see Alaska recidivism rates at 61%, can I assume that the gap between those lower numbers I gave you and the 60 is just violating conditions of parole? Does that count as recidivism? I know it does. But
through the chair, I hesitate to assume what that difference is, okay. But I can certainly look into it.
Thank you. Follow up. Yeah, I guess on overall recidivism, that's a goal that we're all trying to number that we're trying to reduce. And Chair Christ Tompkins mentioned the previous commissioner, and I know that he, along with Senator Kelly and Speaker Edgman, and maybe some others, went to Norway last year and toured their facilities, talked to their corrections officers, mm-hmm. looked at their whole system. And all three of them came back quite impressed, and they gave a presentation that I think I heard Senator Kelly's version of it, and or portion of it, or all three of them. But they had a lot of insight into how that system dealt with recidivism, and I didn't know if you familiarized yourself with that trip that they took or any of that concepts that they maybe picked up over there.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I am aware that there was a trip taken and that those that attended felt that they learned a lot. I haven't been there. I have found some documentation in my office, some paperwork, and I have read that and looked at that. But I'm open to looking at that and institutions everywhere to see what we can learn to beat the recidivism.
Another question?
Yeah.
Not a follow-up, necessarily. You mentioned prison industry, and I know that was a topic that came up in this committee last couple years, programs that they were trying to expand. We did have some testifiers come in that had been at Lemon Creek and worked at some various capacity. One of them said they had a hard time folding laundry now that they're out, because they folded quite a bit while they were in. But earning wages is good for inmates, both to be used inside and to create a bank, so that they do, when they are released, they have some funds to get started. I don't really have a question for that, but I assume you approve of those kind of goals.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I absolutely approve of that.
A follow-up on that one. Regarding money to be used in the facility, do you know the phone call situation, what a phone call costs, the sort of collect call? Has it been modernized and all for, I think for a while you had to call a landline, you couldn't call a cell, I don't know. What's the phone situation? I've heard a lot of complaints from people that have been inside or advocates for them. Can you speak to that?
Through the chair, Rep. Well, what I can tell you is that there are certain pods or areas in different facilities where they may have access to phones easier than others. Sometimes at certain times that they have access. They can call, my understanding is, anybody that's on their approved call list. And that's done through the superintendent there at each facility. And when they call, it is a collect call, and it's paid by the persons on the other end.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up. So do you know what the rate per minute is from a – because I mean, you hear stories, and I think some people said they want to address it. Some people say, well, that's just the cost because we have to listen to every phone call that goes out, and that's expensive. In other words, we have to monitor them for illegal activity. So I don't know. I know they're collect calls. Sometimes people, like a lot of us, have cell phones, and we don't always answer calls. but people call. Anyhow, I guess that doesn't really help if you're trying to call somebody. But you know, you don't know the per minute charge. I've heard it's like several dollars per minute. Is that true?
Through the chair, Rep. Well, I don't know, but I can find out.
Thank you.
And it may be different in different parts of the state. I'll find out for you all.
And I think with that question, we might press pause on
one last question.
Oh, Representative.
Last question.
Okay.
Real simple.
Yeah,
yes or no question.
You'll get
thank you.
The bell lap. Go ahead.
I don't know so much in Alaska, but I've heard a little bit. Pregnant women going to the hospital have a baby. Are they in shackles? Are they allowed to be out of shackles?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, the knowledge that I have is that it's not a cut and dry situation. It depends on the violation that they're in for. Obviously, we want to keep them safe. We want to keep everybody safe.
To be continued. Thank you very much. And as I mentioned, there'll be a second hearing with public testimony, which will be publicly noticed, and appreciate you making yourself available. And we'll move on to the second confirmation hearing, Commissioner Designee Price. Thank you very much as well for joining us. And I'll get the sequence right this time. If you can put yourself on the record and present your biographic sketch, your background, where you're hoping to take the department, and we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you to the chairs and to the committee members. I am really, really pleased to be here. I will apologize a bit in advance. I have this plague that I think many of us are actually struggling with in this building. So I cough dropping and have water here. So forgive me if I have a little meltdown. Mm-hmm. I know that I've had the opportunity to meet with each of you privately, and I've really appreciated having that opportunity. I hope to use today to sort of expound upon some detail about who I am, what my background is, how my background supports the work of the Department of Public Safety, and why it is appropriate, and in my view, that I can serve in the position of commissioner. I am an Alaskan. I was not born here, but I've been up here for 40 years. My family is being raised here. My husband and I live in Anchorage, and we have three very Alaskan kiddos who wear shorts to school in February and swear that they don't need a coat. And I am truly blessed to be able to raise them here. About 20 years ago, I was offered a job that was not at all in the scope of interest that I held at the time. I was studying biology and chemistry. That is where my area of interest was. And I was offered this opportunity to run a small nonprofit organization in this state. And I was intrigued and interested in the position itself because there was a connection to biology and to some science. It was a condition of neurobiological impact that the organization provided service for. So I accepted this job, and through that role, I had the opportunity as executive director to travel to very rural communities and to provide immediate and necessary services to Alaskans in those rural communities. And the reward that I felt from having the opportunity to see those communities, see the need, and then directly be able to meet and provide the need that those Alaskans needed was so rewarding that it really changed the direction of my life. I moved from that role into several other executive director roles for larger nonprofits, for national nonprofits, and continued serving in state nonprofits as executive director, and have served on countless boards for nonprofit organizations with a sole focus of improving and expanding services to Alaskans in the most rural communities. I was very privileged to have that opportunity, but also it afforded me extensive and profound knowledge on strategic planning, on operational management, on operating a significant budget, on being very conscientious with how dollars are spent, and really working to get and ensure the most output for every dollar that is utilized. And I also had the opportunity to engage in media relations, public relations, and start to delve into policy development and legislative interaction. When I moved to accept the position as executive director at Standing Together Against Rape, which is the sole rape crisis center for the state, that's where my passion for service sort of met what became ultimately my genuine passion, which is working with victims of violence in this state. While I was employed as the executive director for STAR, I had the benefit of working with exceptional professionals in the Special Victims Unit, the Crimes Against Children's Unit, the Alaska Bureau of Investigations, at OCS forensic nursing and family care coordinators and advocates, and saw firsthand and developed, in fact, a multidisciplinary coordinated collaborative response that improved our ability as a state to hold offenders accountable while also supporting victims in that process. That experience also opened my eyes and gave me a very deep understanding of the gaps in service that our criminal justice system faces and the challenges that law enforcement faces, particularly in rural communities. When I moved from STAR to become the senior advisor on crime policy and prevention for Governor Bill Walker, I was assisting him in a variety of capacities, but there were three unrelated cases that crossed my desk, and through a variety of looking through those cases and the concerns that those Alaskan families put forward, it led me to require on the governor's behalf a statewide audit of our law enforcement entities that ultimately led to the focus that we see now on unprocessed and unsubmitted sexual assault kits. So that work really influenced a sustainable change that we continue to see today on how this state addresses forensic evidence, not just in sexual assault cases, but across the board, and how we will process them and be responsible to victims of violent crime and ensuring that we are responding adequately. I've been a member of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, who I actually had the pleasure of spending an hour with today, and it was quite a lovely interaction. I have been a member of the National Criminal Justice Association and really a number of public safety-focused national organizations, federal entities that focus on public safety, housing and homeless coalitions, and have committed a great deal of my time and volunteerism outside my professional career to expanding services throughout this state. I have a very strong understanding of adverse childhood experiences, how those adverse childhood experiences link directly to the crime rates that we see today, and an understanding of the fact that we as a state need to begin at some point to address those experiences in children and determine how we're going to move forward with an eye on preventing this generation from re-victimizing and re-perpetrating at the same levels of violence that we are experiencing today. My prior work has allowed me to develop really strong relationships within AST specifically. I have the great benefit of counting retired Colonel Jim Cockrell as a dear friend of mine. I believe he submitted a letter of support to you all. Along with that, I worked very closely with Commissioner Gary Folger and more closely with Commissioner Walt Monaghan, who was also at one point, many, many moons ago, my boss. So in terms of reaching back, I agreed with you, Representative Christ Tompkins, about the import of having those connections during transition. And retired Commissioner Monaghan has just had knee replacement surgery, but he has promised me that we will sit down as soon as he has had a moment to enjoy his third retirement and get his knee replacement all under control. I bring that to your attention because I am an unconventional choice for the position of commissioner for the Department of Public Safety in terms of historically what this position has seen. Historically, governors have appointed a career law enforcement professional to serve in this capacity, and there is a great deal of benefit to that. And the men who have served in this position have sacrificed, their families have sacrificed, and they have been diligent public servants for many, many years. That being said, the department and the position of commissioner specifically needs to take a step back and recognize what the position actually entails. And the position of commissioner for this department is not a law enforcement position. It is a civilian administrator position tasked specifically with providing overall policy and management to the department, overseeing the boards, councils, and divisions of the department, working with the legislature to ensure that the governor's and the department's initiatives and goals are being met, and to ensure that the resources allocated to the department are parsed out within the department to ensure that mission-critical services are being delivered. The mission of this department is very, very clear. The statutory obligation is to protect life and property, and the constitutional authority identifies the need to protect the public. Those are very simply the department's core missions, and there are a number of divisions, boards, and councils housed under DPS that serve those critical public safety functions. I believe, without question, that this department has been remiss in supporting a variety of those divisions that exist within the department. Most people, when we think of the Department of Public Safety, identify a trooper and think of the department exclusively in terms of the Alaska State Troopers. And there is a great deal more work that is put forward on behalf of Alaska from this department. There are, in fact, more than half of our employees that are not Alaska State or Alaska Wildlife Troopers. included in DPS, and bear with me for a moment. I just want to take the opportunity to highlight and lift up briefly some of those divisions and the work they do. The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault funds 24 emergency shelter programs in very rural communities throughout the state. They also have a great deal of work focused on primary prevention efforts. They also work with entities like child advocacy centers to wrap services around children who witness or experience trauma. They really serve a critical function in working to provide emergency safe placement for individuals who experience domestic violence, but also work diligently to work in terms of preventing those crimes from occurring in the future. The Division of Fire and Life Safety has statewide jurisdiction for plan review and fire code enforcement. And I just like to point out the importance of the work this division does. And in my opinion, they've been one of the most under-supported divisions within this department. If you think in terms of churches, schools, and community centers in our rural communities, having a focus on evaluating plan reviews and ensuring that there is safe building constructs in place in those communities works to reduce fire fatalities. And yet we have consistently seen historically in this department that that division has been underfunded. So I aim to improve that and ensure that they have adequate deputy fire marshals who do the arson investigations and the fire fatality investigations, as well as adequate staffing to ensure that the impact to commerce is lessened and that those plan reviews are able to be approved in a more streamlined fashion. The Division of Statewide Services houses our Criminal Records and Identification Bureau, and it is led by, I'm just going to brag on her a minute, and I know she's watching and she just won't like this at all, but our nationally recognized professional, many of you may know her, Kathy Monfreda. That Statewide Services division includes the sex offender registration, which we have approximately 3,500 of here in our state currently. The division also manages the concealed carry permits, which we have approximately 11,000 in the state currently. They also house the fingerprint ID system, the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, as well as emergency dispatch services and 911 services. Of course, we have the State Crime Lab that provides forensic services for all law enforcement statewide, also the Police Standards Council, Fire Standards Council, and of course, Alaska Wildlife Troopers, which we have 88 of right now, Alaska State Troopers, which we have about 301. We've got 19 that just started in our academy on Friday, and 5 lateral recruits, meaning they have prior law enforcement experience that are in field training right now. The Alaska State Troopers also administer the Village Public Safety Officer Program, which I know from my conversations with you and from around the building that there is some concern and some dialogue that I'm interested and enthusiastic about engaging with you in and happy to answer any questions about. To just briefly provide priorities, I believe that direction of the department is quite clear. We aim to improve the access and response time in rural communities. We aim to recruit and retain troopers and the essential civilian personnel to support those troopers. And then just as an aside, I take as a significant personal responsibility the need to support the men and women who serve this department by serving them and ensuring that they have adequate training, adequate equipment to safely do their job, but even further than that, to ensure that we are cognizant of their wellness and their emotional well-being and the difficult jobs that they perform. I am very passionate about this work, and I feel very strongly that with my experience coupled with the law enforcement experience of the deputy commissioner that I have named, both of the colonels of each of the wildlife and state trooper divisions, and the incredibly talented staff members housed all throughout this department, we are exceptionally placed to move forward in a really positive direction and meet the governor's goal of improving public safety for the state. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide that overview and look forward to answering questions.
Great. Questions from the committee. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Commissioner Price. I definitely appreciate talking about all divisions within the department. Countless rural communities without local public safety of any kind have reported that trooper dispatch refuses to deploy troopers to remote areas when residents call for public safety help, such as when individuals are threatening violence. You know, when we hear about this, what we hear is the trooper dispatch says, call us when you have a body. Is it a DPS policy not to dispatch troopers until a violent crime has actually been committed, even when we have advance warning of potentially dangerous and even potentially deadly behavior?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, thank you for the question. That's a very challenging question to answer, and what I will say is that we have to follow state law. So right now, in fact, the governor's proposed crime bill provides a fix to the challenge that you are specifically identifying. If there is not a threat of harm, if there's a generalized terroristic threat, is what we would call that. Right now, our troopers may or may not, depending on the scenario, have the legal right or responsibility to respond to that scenario. The governor has put forward a bill that does provide for a generalized threat of harm to receive a response from law enforcement prior to an actual incident of harm occurring, which we deem to be an improvement, a tool for law enforcement to arrive, de-escalate the scenario before an incident of harm arrives. I believe it's been a flaw in our state law.
Thank you. If I could ask a couple follow-ups, yeah, just to get through rural, some rural related rural sure. public safety issues. OMB Director Don Arduin stated on record in Senate Finance that different departments and commissioners suggested areas within their budget that the administration could cut. Were you aware, and so first, did you propose a $3 million VPSO cut, or was that Don Arduin? And were you aware when that cut was proposed that there were still 5 months remaining for contractors to use the previously appropriated $3 million?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, yes, I was certainly aware mathematically of the time frame in the calendar fiscal year that they have to utilize those funds. The negative supplemental that was introduced was the governor's negative supplemental introduced by the governor and OMB. I will work within the budget that I am ultimately appropriated for that program to ensure that the grantees have adequate funding to continue to recruit and hire VPSOs, to continue to pay, purchase the supply, the fuel, the travel, and the training. And I am 100% confident that every of the 10 grantees has adequate funding to do so for the remaining of the remainder of this fiscal year.
I've heard.
Follow up?
Yes, please. Thank you. I've heard that and this is just something that I've heard, is DPS has been slow to issue and clear background checks on VPSO candidates who are ready to begin work, causing delays in the VPSO hiring process. Is that something that you've heard about or something that your department is working to address?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I have not heard of that specifically. I would say, barring additional knowledge about where that complaint might be coming from, I've not witnessed it myself. I'm actually directly involved with the hiring right now because we're focusing on recruitment and ensuring that those positions are filled. So we're seeing those backgrounds clear quickly. I think if I may be so bold as to throw a guess as to what that might refer to, we do have individuals who, for example, have a recent felony in their background who are seeking an appeal to their denial for hire, and that process does take time, and simply it always will, because we have to do our due diligence and ensure that the individuals we allow to be hired in that position are in a safe position to provide that service for the community.
Final follow-up, if I might.
Yeah, Representative Fields.
As we've discussed, VPSOs aren't the only frontline first responders in rural Alaska. Could you talk about other strategies that you're working on, including but not limited to VPSOs, to ensure that we can continue to work toward having first responders in every community in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, yes, and thank you for asking that question. I would need a great deal more time to explain all of the conversations that are taking place, and I will share one or two with you, but what I will say without hesitation is that the concept and the deployment of improving rural public safety, both the response and the number of professionals and first responders available to provide that response, is a priority of this department and is probably the single thing that takes up the majority of my day and the command staff's day on a regular basis right now. Some of the ideas that we have, and I am comfortable putting them forward, but I do just want to provide the caveat that they're not vetted and we're not ready to move any of these conversations forward until we have the opportunity to collaborate with the grantees a bit more. But the grantees, for example, have indicated that one of the challenges that they experience in hiring village public safety officers is, in their perspective, sort of the regulations associated with how they can use the grant funding. So we're evaluating what those grant agreements look like and trying to see if there is an opportunity for the state to be a bit more hands-off in what some of those regulations are, the backgrounds, for example, and removing some of those and perhaps allowing a cleaner delivery of funding to the grantees to hire more freely. I think there's some concern because as a state, we're responsible for that response. So we wanna make sure that those decisions are made that are in the best interest of the state. So providing a more hands-off experience and giving more control to the grantees, I think is a little bit new for this department and somewhat concerning, but we're certainly considering it. There's also some project consideration about potentially funding a straight dollar amount to villages, incorporated villages with 50 or more people, to hire a village police officer. There's a great deal of conversation about what project might work. We do not have a silver bullet at this moment for how we're going to improve rural public safety.
Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to follow up on that line of thought. Is can you explain your jurisdiction as commissioner over the VPSOs and the difference between them and a state trooper?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes, and thank you for that question. It is actually quite a complex scenario. So there's a statute that governs the Village Public Safety Officer Program. That statute indicates that there is created in the Department of Public Safety a Village Public Safety Officer Program, that the legislature shall appropriate funding to the Department of Public Safety, that the Department of Public Safety shall grant those funds to the regional nonprofit corporations for hire and oversight of those positions. So simply put, the legislature and the governor appropriate that line item to the department, and I am to grant that funding out to the 10 different nonprofit organizations. Those nonprofit organizations essentially serve as employers. They are employers, which means that that's 10 different employers who have 10 different levels of compensation, 10 different levels of benefits, 10 different levels of how many hours of work a week an individual is serving. So we have one grantee who hires a VPSO to work 37 and a half hours a week, one grantee who hires a VPSO to work 40 hours a week. They may offer less compensation or more compensation. The state caps the compensation, but they still have opportunity within that field, if you will. So that is inherently one of the structural challenges with the development of the VPSO program, is the VPSOs, when I speak to VPSOs and when our troopers who provide oversight to VPSOs speak to them, what we hear from those individuals is they don't feel supported, they don't feel that they're getting adequate training, and we as the state are responsible for line iteming in the grant delivery of grant funding, funding for travel and funding for training, but it's the grantee's obligation and accountability to ensure that their VPSOs are getting that training. And DPS, in fact, provides that training, but it's still the grantee's responsibility to use those funds and ensure that their VPSOs are trained, which of course means that in the 10 employers that we have, one may be exceptional at utilizing that line item and exceptional at training their VPSOs, and another may not be. So there's no uniformity and no standardization, and I as commissioner have no authority to deliver those services differently.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So my understanding is that of the 10 employers of the BPSOs, the administrative charges range from 7 to 10% on the low level to 48% for overhead charges. Is that your understanding also? And if it is, are you concerned about the amount of money that might be going towards administration of the grants as opposed to the actual VPSO services?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you are correct. The top administrative cost is the top indirect rate is 48%, and we have one grantee who is at 9% administrative cost. The average of the administrative cost across the board for the 10 programs is 33.4%. I am quite concerned about that. I believe that the intent of the legislature and the governor in appropriating that funding is to improve rural public safety, and I am concerned that the high administrative costs associated with the grantees delivering that service is impeding our ability to use the spirit of the funding that's being allocated to improve that response. There was also some intent language written by the legislature 2 years ago that indicated that if the average administrative or indirect costs associated with the program exceeded 30%, that the program should be reevaluated and some structural shifts should occur, perhaps some caps on what those indirect rates look like. And yet we are here today looking at an average of almost 34% indirect rate. So I don't know if any conversation previously has been engaged in with the grantees about that legislative intent, the language of that legislative intent, and what that might look like if we were to influence some changes. The department is concerned about the 48 cents on every dollar that the state's expending on improving rural public safety going to overhead, yes.
So just to follow up on that, so what do the grant administrators do for their either 9 or 10% to their 48%? And is there any difference between what the administrator does who is charging 48% versus the one who is charging, did you say 9 or 10%?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there is no difference in the administrative work capacity of the program coordinators administering the fund. The difference in the indirect rate is that at some point in the last, I think, 6-7 years, the department entered into agreements with the grantees to allow them to charge the state their federally negotiated indirect rate, as Department of Health and Social Services had contractually entered into those agreements with the similar bodies. That those grantees came to the department in distress and wondered why one state entity was not allowing them to charge the federally negotiated indirect rate and another state entity was allowing them to charge the federally negotiated indirect rate. And at that time, the department decided that allowing them to charge that federally negotiated indirect rate was appropriate. I think that that should be reevaluated.
Follow up?
So when the federal government has a grant that they give an entity, they allow that entity to charge 48% for administrative costs?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. And I believe that there is, I probably shouldn't say this because I'm not 100% sure, but I will just indicate, I believe, and I can get you some more information on this, that the indirect rate that they negotiate includes a variety of other reasonings behind why, with the federal government specifically, the rate makes sense for them. That doesn't mean that those reasonings would make sense for the state to pay, in my opinion. I think it deserves some additional analysis.
Thank you.
I'm going to insert myself into the queue. A couple of questions. First, do you think the Trooper Academy belongs in Sitka?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I have a strong answer for that. I don't want to dodge the question. What I would say is I would expect to see a really diligent and significant cost analysis if there was a recommendation for it to move. I think that anytime you talk about moving a program like that, you have to keep an eye on what the costs are going to be, what the cost benefit is going to be. I think there is benefit to the paramilitary style in which we train at our academy being a bit removed from, say, a more urban community like Anchorage. They are housed in dorms. They are collectively in this they're immersed in this experience. But I wouldn't be opposed or supportive of the academy moving. I simply don't have enough information to make that determination.
Thank you. And to your opening comments, I appreciated your comments about the other aspects, the sort of unheralded sub-entities of DPS, the sort of Scotty Pippins of the department, if you will, and Division of Fire and Life Safety, your comments about increasing the number of deputy fire marshals and streamlining or expediting turnaround of building construction review. I actually haven't reviewed the governor's proposed budget for Division of Fire and Life Safety. But would you be able to speak to any changes in the proposed budget and in order to presumably create the capacity to achieve those outcomes? How do you envision doing that without more money, as I assume the governor's proposed budget probably doesn't have more money for the division?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And the governor's proposed budget, we are we're very, very grateful at the Department of Public Safety that the governor's proposed budget does not see any cuts outside of what has already, I think, we've all addressed individually in our one-on-one meetings, the $3 million reduction to the Village Public Safety Officer Program. I believe comprehensively, when you look at UGF, it was 3.265 is what's viewed as the reduction, but there's a zero line impact to the Alaska State Troopers, to the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, to the Division of Fire and Life Safety. They're even budgets. And though the rest of the funds associated with the negative in UGF for DPS was a 50% cut in travel costs to every administrative budget, and then some realignment that took place, which what doesn't it, it's not actually a loss. It was just some fiscal cleanup, if you will. That being said, I think we at the department have a lot of opportunity to make significant movements and improvements within the budget that the legislature appropriated to this department last year. And I'll use a real-time example for you. Colonel Massey, who is seated behind me, is the colonel of our Alaska Wildlife Trooper Division. And Colonel Massey put forward a supplemental budget request for vessel repair just yesterday. This is probably going to be news to him. Sorry, Colonel. The repair is essential. The repair is critical. That was never the question or the concern. The colonel did all of his due diligence in informing the department why the need for the repair was needing to be funded. When we start combing through the budget, however, what we find is due to a variety of different philosophical viewpoints on capital appropriations and how to hold capital appropriations or spend capital appropriations, the department actually has a more than significant capital appropriation budget available to fund the necessary repairs of the vessel in question and to replace a recently decommissioned vessel to meet the need of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. So to just say it a little bit more plainly, I think that the evaluation of the budget with an incredibly critical eye provides me the opportunity to ensure that every division has adequate resources, including additional opportunities to support our plan review inspectors financially, making sure we have the adequate number of personnel without needing to ask the legislature for additional funding this year. Next year will be a different story.
Exciting. More with the same, basically.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chairman, we will absolutely have to request more money next year.
Or Representative Vance.
Thank you. When I did my trooper ride-along on the Lower Peninsula, one of the requests was a better IT equipment. And there was a large structure of compilation of equipment that didn't work. And we did go and pick up someone who had a warrant, transferred them to a local facility, and he needed to print up the warrant. And I went inside the facility, and their printer and, you know, IT didn't work. He went back to his car to print up something, had to get a zip. It was just this one problem after another that prolonged the time that he was there and not on the street. So is that something that you have found in the budget that you can meet for this fiscal year, the needs to help streamline just some of the efficiencies of having their boots on the ground and making the process, you know, for the people that have been arrested a little bit smoother, to be able to meet that need, that to help them do their job better? Is that something that you're finding that you can handle this year, or is that part of the ask for next year?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, thank you. I know the troopers are cheering as they hear your question. I do not have enough information on what the systems are that we need to improve and or repair in order to responsibly ask for a dollar amount to provide whatever the replacement is going to look like. And when I say that the department has a tremendous opportunity in terms of strategic planning. That is precisely one of the arenas in which I am identifying. So troopers are doing their job. They're getting by. They're making it work. One trooper, one riot. They make it work. They should not be in a position that they are having to do that. It's not safe for them. It's not safe for the community. And it's not fiscally responsible of us, because we know how much a trooper costs per hour, and having them expend time on that sort of detail is not efficient. However, we will need to do a full analysis and evaluation of what every post, what every trooper has, is using, what is working, what isn't working. We, for example, have computers in HQ that were ordered for our statewide drug enforcement units, and I just happened to see them and asked a question about them, and they're sitting there, and they will be brilliantly supportive of our unit when they're built out. So when I asked the natural next question of when is that build out going to occur, we didn't have that information. We don't have an IT department that's been supported or encouraged to ensure that we have a strong prioritization of projects as they come in. How are they communicating the build out of those computers for the statewide drug enforcement unit? When can they expect those units to be built out? That's just one example. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity to improve the IT capacity of the department before we ask for more money. We need to understand what our challenges are and what the replacement and options would be, and we don't know that right now.
Follow-up? So with the topic of IT, do you have the latitude to work with the communications director, the commissioner of IT statewide, to meet that need, or is that something that falls within your department?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we actually have IT members housed in our department. They are a member, their division is a part of our statewide services division, and half of our IT employees are OIT employees and half are DPS employees, but they all identify DPS as their primary customer. So we do have them in-house in HQ, and they're exceptional. We have exceptionally talented individuals that serve in that arena. What we don't have is really an expectation of what projects are going to be prioritized, how they're going to be prioritized, how they're going to communicate if they need to, for example, contract with an external expert on a particular project. There's just no system in place. It's a plug the hole, plug the bleed when it pops up, instead of with forethought, plan on an appropriate maintenance and replacement program. So we find ourselves plugging the bleed a lot.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yes, one of the concerns I was, that's very important, of course, is having enough safety officers. And I'm wondering what you're planning to do to help with recruitment and retaining officers. And one of the things I heard about was the importance of returning to a defined benefit option. I've heard many police officers speak about that, and troopers, and I'm besides what you're hoping to do to help with recruitment and retention, do you support reinstating a defined benefit option?
Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you for your question. So specific to Alaska State Troopers and Alaska Wildlife Troopers, with regards to recruitment, we have, for lack of a better way of explaining it, a perfect recipe right now. So we have the appropriate, incredible leadership charged with our recruitment unit, Lieutenant DeGraff. And it was really a slight and small tweak, but I cannot tell you the impact. It's exponential. And the tweak was changing the culture from you as an applicant are lucky if you're selected to you as an applicant are valuable to us, and we want to see you succeed and help you process through the system in a way that allows you to be successful. The expectations were never lowered. What we expect of our applicants is incredibly high, as it should be for a premier law enforcement agency, but the culture of that unit under Lieutenant DeGraff and Sergeant Wilson is one of you are important to us and we're going to help you move through this. On Friday, we saw the largest academy that we've seen since 2003. I am committed and have communicated clearly with the recruitment unit. What you need, you will get. Tell me what you need, you will get it. We are aggressively pursuing lateral recruits, which is individuals with prior law enforcement experience. and the department has not ever had a strategic plan surrounding how to approach and recruit laterals. We have 5 laterals right now that are in field training. We anticipate doing another lateral academy, which is an abbreviated academy, so it's much less expensive for the state to hire a lateral recruit. And we have approved an expenditure for them to actively pursue recruiting those laterals. In terms of retention, in December, when I first came on board, I evaluated a 2017 commissioned officer employee survey, and that survey I found quite disturbing, but I was not surprised to read the results of it. Many of the commissioned officers indicated that they had incredibly low morale. They questioned the integrity of leadership. There was a lot of words that were used that were very negative in reference to leadership and the culture of leadership that existed, good old boy club. There was sort of a word jumble that was created during that survey using the most frequently used words, and they were quite disheartening to read. I took that and launched a voluntary recruitment work group, and I sent it out truly not knowing if the men and women who serve would be interested in engaging in a work group of that capacity, and received back over 50 interested parties, all ranks. My directive was I want all ranks, boots on the ground, and I don't want it command heavy. We got 52 interested parties. I put our HR manager and Lieutenant Kid Chan, who is our training director, in charge of sort of moving that recruitment work group forward. And the directives I gave them were pretty simple. I used the employee engagement survey itself, and any category that scored as sub-neutral or sub-average, those were the categories that they were to work together to develop between 3 and 5 policy recommendations to deliver to me by March 8th. And just to give you an example, one of them that graded sub-neutral was we do not have adequate training. So what I charge them with is define what adequate training looks like for you, because that's sort of nebulous. So does adequate training look like in service days? Is it specialized training? Develop those 3 to 5 recommendations and deliver them to me so that we can determine and evaluate how we can get those services back to the men and women who are saying that's what they need. Another was that graded subpar was my commander doesn't know what I do every day. And that was a very direct line to the directive of travel restrictions. So within the Department of Public Safety, there was a freeze on travel, and that meant that commanders could not travel to post. So when I met with commanders, I asked them, when's the last time you were in post? And they looked at me sort of like I was crazy and said, we have travel restrictions. And I said, not for mission critical travel, you don't. And they said, well, ma'am, what do you deem to be mission critical? And I said, visiting your post is mission critical. But that was really a shift and a change in culture for them. And so those are the sort of things.
Sorry to interrupt, Commissioner Price. And this is for the benefit of the committee.
Yes.
I've got a 4:45 with our finance committee counterparts for finance subcommittee. And I might want to refocus us on the question asked by Representative Story, but also just give notice that we maybe just have time for a couple more questions as well. So I apologies to interrupt, but just wanted to give the opportunity maybe to retether Representative Story.
Thank you. I appreciate your enthusiasm and all that you are recalling. But I did want to know about the defined benefits contribution option.
The department has not taken a position on any legislation that has been introduced regarding defined benefits. And to the best of my knowledge, there is not a piece of legislation that's been introduced regarding defined benefits.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
Yeah. And there, I believe the Senate has introduced a bill, Senator Keel. So undefined benefit option. So, but one thing that was I really wanted to just—it's a really important topic, and that is the murdered and missing Indigenous women, and it's obviously a tragedy. And I'm wondering, do you plan on focusing resources on this important area?
Through the chair, Representative Story, the department has always focused resources in that area. So yes. I think the recent arrest in the Sophie Sergey case reflects that the department has consistently and diligently been investigating cold cases, investigating missing and murdered Alaskans. And yes, the answer is that we will continue to do so.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Lateral hires, where are you getting your lateral hires from?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, wherever we can get them.
Would that be in-state? Follow-up.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in and out of state, yes.
So I guess I want to ask, as a resident of Anchorage, where there's been an attempt to beef up the Anchorage police force, why should I be happy if you are doing a lateral hire from the Anchorage Police Department to the state?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we are not actively headhunting Anchorage Police Department officers. However, we are a choice for them should they decide to leave their department for any number of reasons. The Anchorage Police Department is a strong partner of the Department of Public Safety, to include a press conference earlier today that highlighted the work that we partnered on that led to the arrest of 28 felons. So they are a strong partner, and harming them is certainly not within the intent of the department. We need the collaborative partnership in order to deliver public safety services.
And last question, person in the queue, Representative Fields, and we'll be back for public testimony. And if there's overflow questions, I'm sure we can find the opportunity for that. Representative Fields.
Thanks. I wanted to follow up on Representative Story's question. I'd like to see the governor's office come out in clear support of a defined benefit package. That's the most important issue that we've heard on recruitment or retention of frontline public safety personnel. And I also want to ask a follow-up question. Do you support adding additional capacity to the Alaska Bureau of Investigations, which has one cold case investigator for 130 cold cases? That's 13 times fewer than national best practices recommend. We know from other jurisdictions that in terms of missing and murdered indigenous women, inadequate cold case investigatory capacity can be responsible for failing to catch serial killers. So will you commit to seeking additional resources for the Alaska Bureau of Investigation so that we are actually tracking down these cold cases? Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I commit to ensuring that the troopers that we have available are placed in the most responsible positions available and necessary for the betterment of public safety in Alaska. Can I commit directly to your question? No, sir, I cannot at this moment.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee Price, for making the time today, and we'll be in touch about public testimony. And
apologies for my verbosity. I do get excited.
No, your enthusiasm is appreciated. A couple of thanks to Madison and Martha, and I'd also like to thank Grace, who's the committee aide and keeps things running, especially in this co-chair arrangement. And again, we'll have firm times and locations for both finance subcommittees soon, maybe even within the next 15 minutes. And we'll be in touch with committee members about that. And the next meeting is 3 p.m. this Thursday, February 28th, here in the Max Grunberg room. Thank you, and we're adjourned at 4:45.